This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm proposing that in the next 10 years, we're going to see 1 billion people die of starvation because I'm eating burgers, because I went to McDonald's. Rapid population decline or bust.
She gave us everything.
Each person on Earth is overestimating his or her abilities to muddle through when the world breaks down.
What we needed to grow and evolve.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. When it comes to the population bomb, our feature speaker today makes Paul Ehrlich sound like an optimist. Now it's over 30 years into the tragedy of exploding humanity on a small planet. Jack Alpert says it's time for rapid population decline or bust. That bust may haul down civilization, taking us back thousands of years. In Roman times, there were about 100 million humans on the planet. It turns out, according to Jack, with reasonable scientific investigation, that is the maximum sustainable population, 100 million, to live anything like our current lifestyle in the developed world. This year of 2011, somewhere on the planet, the 7 billionth baby will be born, along with almost 500,000 more babies, that very same day. Of course, other humans will die. All told, the number of humans on Earth increases by about 217,000 a day and climbing. This crushes people, economies, governments, other species, and the whole world environment. The crisis has arrived. It is time to hear from Jack Alpert. Long ago, he invented seatbelts, saving hundreds of thousands of lives, perhaps millions. He went on to research peculiarities in the human brain and personal functioning, strange human traits that could end this civilization to dangle on the edge of extinction. Those are strong words, and this is a strong radio program. I don't recommend it for the severely depressed or impressionable young children, say under age 9. Save this one for the grown-ups and young people whose lives are threatened.
The basic premise is that we're underestimating human predicament. So the conversation that happened in this living room does not reflect, you know, the piano that's going to fall on us. As concerned as you are and as aggressive as you are in getting the word out and helping people understand it and being scared about things that you think are out of whack, you're still underestimating the predicament. And so I think that's my line to the grandmother. I've got to figure out a way to trip her from everything's okay, I've lived my whole life, things have gotten better continuously, they've never gotten bad. I expect my kids to be in better shape than me. They're going to go to college and get a better education, and they're going to live longer, and they're going to have better health care. And whatever's going to happen is going to be better than what happened to me. My objective is to trip somebody and say, no, here's why it's not going to be better. In fact, for most people, it's going to be worse, and that's why you should focus on this.
There are three reasons, I think, why Jack Alpert will never be popular and why this radio program is difficult to make and difficult to listen to. Number one, Jack admits he is not a master communicator. He is an engineer, often operating in fields well ahead of his time, before social acceptance. Number two, the material is difficult to communicate. It must cross boundaries where conversation has been hidden or forbidden for years. At times, he is trying to express in his studies the limitations of the human mind, but those same limitations prevent many people from readily understanding it. Number three, the subject and the options are so horrible, we don't want to hear it, much less think about it. The food riots have already begun to bring down governments, threatening us with chaos in the coming decades. With the spectacle of mass suffering and starvation all over the world, and that heartbreak will enter even the most prosperous houses, like an accusing ghost over the dinner table. We must try. The scene was an unassuming living room in the home of a Greenpeace founder in the city of Vancouver, where Greenpeace was born. Six of the brightest minds gathered around to hear Jack Alpert and to again work through the endless question, what is to be done? Plus one Alex Smith with not enough microphones, permission granted to record what I could. My main microphone went to Jack Alpert. Then I did three follow-up phone interviews to get you audio suitable for radio. The interviews are with Rex Wyler, Greenpeace co-founder, historian for that organization, regularly published pundit on the environment and peak oil, Dr. William or Bill Reese, the co-inventor of the ecological footprint idea, an amazing thinker and scientist at the University of British Columbia, and with Vandy Savage, a community organizer, project leader, and person extraordinaire. No time to waste. Here is Jack Alpert telling the seatbelt story and how that led him to conclude humans may be too stupid to survive.
We put these seatbelts in. People stopped dying.
I mean, you said 26,000.
1 in 26,000 Americans would have died in their car if they would have worn their... The argument is that people didn't wear seatbelts, even though the data was perfectly clear that it was a really good idea. Okay? Really, I mean, I was disheartened. I was one of these, you know, do good engineers, and I had done something good, and it wasn't going to make any difference.
It wasn't compulsory,
so they didn't, you know, we started building key interlocks and seatbelt interlocks and all kinds of things. Eventually, they just passed the law about you had to strap your baby in. And after that, if you grew up wearing your seatbelt, then kids today will put their seatbelts on automatically. But that's not the point. The point is that the polio vaccination had exactly the same function. If you got vaccinated, you didn't get injured. Now, the same decision maker who wouldn't think of not getting their child vaccinated was the same person who wouldn't wear their seatbelt. So things in the time domain, in certain time domains, are opaque. And so most of my research is about how do you make temporal activities where the action is today and the outcome is in the future, or the action of most of the people today, you know, not you by yourself, but you in a group, will change the future. In those domains, we suck. Okay, I wrote an interactive computer exam. I gave it to sixth graders. Okay, I gave them an island. I gave them a bag of beans. I gave them some cows. And if they planted the bean, they got 375 beans. When they were feeding the cows beans, if they fed them 500 beans, the cow lived. If they fed her 501 beans, she reproduced. And if you fed her 499 beans, she died. It was called the Hammurabi problem. And I just inverted it. So I took out all the uncertainty and made it possible for the kid to make the calculations using sixth grade math and fifth grade reading so they could actually figure out how many animals were going to be alive at the end of the first year, how many animals were going to be alive at the end of the second year. They got points for 1 point for every animal was alive at the first year, 2 for the second year, so on. And then 2,000 points off for every animal you killed. So this is a pretty easy problem. And not only that, you can figure your way out through the problem and then come back and make your decisions in the first year. Well, only one kid of all the Palo Alto sixth graders that I gave it to could do it. One. The rest failed miserably. So then I said, well, let's go from sixth graders to Stanford students. They got to be brighter. They're older. They're filtered. Yeah. Nobody did it. So then I said, I then went to the faculty and I had them do it. And then my final group was all the Nobel laureates and Wolf Prize winners that I could snake into having to take the exam. From the scores, and these are, you know, this is not a really good statistical problem. I mean, it's not, the experiment would have had to have been redone carefully. But the inference is that in this domain of understanding, the Nobel laureates and the sixth graders are in the same park. They have the same abilities and they suck. When there's no uncertainty and there's a way to calculate out the implications of your actions, you would rather do trial and error and die than... They weren't willing to use logic. They wanted to experiment through the crisis, which is what our society is doing. We're facing this crisis, and we want to experiment our way through, and the probability that we're going to be successful this time around experimenting our way through is...
In case we miss it, humans might well go to hell or even extinction because of a limitation in our brains. Even though we have the capability to work out what the future will be and a way to get to a better future... We prefer to muddle through using trial and error, and we'll do it time after time. That is true of sixth graders, of college professors, and Nobel laureates. Only one person, a child, ever stopped to figure out the right answer to Jack's puzzle. That person later invented a basic building block of the internet communication among humans. Just one. Case in point, human-induced climate change. We know what triggers big changes, our changes to the atmosphere. We know what will happen. We know how to fix it, but we'd have to give up some things now. Instead, we keep burning fossil fuels and leave it to our kids and grandkids to muddle through. We believe in muddling through. It's always better than a plan. That is our nature. The same thing happens with an obviously non-renewable resource like oil. We know it will run out, but expect to muddle through rather than taking action now to prevent a future collapse. If Jack Alpert only contributes one thing to the world, this alone will be enough. Humans will use trial and error even when an obvious logical path to success is available. That is the nature of the beast. That is our next challenge for evolution. Or can cultural evolution, based on science, overcome this innate flaw? Alpert has given up on the mass media and mass politics to affect social change. He also does not believe current politicians will begin rapid population reduction. Instead, he wants to create tools that will change the mind of just one person. He has chosen a campaign to target grandmothers. He wants to convince just one grandmother to wear a button saying RPD for rapid population decline, and to give the tools to that grandmother to convert another grandmother. If each just converts one more a month, and it spreads in a viral way, in about 32 months, millions of grandmothers will be wearing these buttons at the next rallies. Jack Alpert has calculated there are enough grandmothers in America who vote to outweigh all the other voters who will be split in their loyalties to other parties and all the young people who don't vote, even though they could. To get the grandmothers' votes, the politician would have to promise a program of rapid population decline at home and abroad. Later, we will hear Jack explain his main conclusion that only rapid population decline can save us from horror or oblivion. Cuts in developed world lifestyles will not save us in time, he says, and nobody wants to cut back on their lifestyles anyway, unless they're forced to, and then it's too late. People all over the world want to live the fossil-fueled life party of plenty, or at least to have some dependable food, light, heat, electricity. Given what we have seen already, that humans are not willing to change lifestyles very much, the only solution is to have a lot less humans. Later, Jack will show us how many humans could inhabit this planet and live the way we do, sustainably, for thousands of years or endlessly. But first, let's hear Jack explain one way to achieve rapid population decline.
No, there's nothing sexual about this. In my model, everybody gets to be sterile, and everybody get and the reversals are handed out completely randomly. I believe the world can peacefully and sustainably support one person for every 100 people that exist today, and that is essentially the population of South Korea. So we're talking about a really small number of people. I'm going to take all the resources and bring them over to some great location where they can live and don't have to transport things far, and thus they have the highest possible standard of living for that number. And if they don't like how they want it higher, they need a smaller number. Okay, what do I mean by rapid? In the lifetime of my children. And the faster the decline, the better, because even if we started implementing rapid population decline tomorrow, it would not save a billion people who are going to starve to death in the next 10 years. And it won't save the 2 or 3 billion people who will die fighting to stay alive in the next 20 years, as their labor will not provide the means to support them. However, I do believe implementing rapid population decline might avoid a complete bust. It might avoid a civilization collapse that would turn all children into this child. Know the conclusion. We're underestimating overpopulation. The only justification for giving out 350,000 birth permits for the whole globe is a realization that you can only have 35 million people in 70 years, or nobody will die from a natural death. They're all going to be fighting with one another. It'll all be social conflict. Everybody's sterile, and the permit allows you to get it reversed.
Yeah, but everybody's not sterile.
Everybody will be sterile. Let's assume that
let's assume
there's actually a virus loose in the population.
Let's assume that we get Bill Gates to put $35 billion into building a sterility virus.
Are you going to get people into it?
Aerosol. I mean, we're talking about the technical. You want some shock value? Let's assume that the city goes under and the grocery stores are empty and you live at the edge of the city. Okay? And here comes this guy with this little girl and they haven't eaten for 3 days. And he marches up on your front porch and he says, really, we're really hungry. We haven't eaten in 3 days. And you have a choice between letting him in and feeding him, which means that your kids aren't going to have food, or sending him away, or if he doesn't want to go away, you have to shoot him or he's going to shoot you. When you're faced with that dilemma, when these bodies start piling up on your front porch because your cupboard is full and his cupboard is not, I mean, he's not a normal person. I mean, he's not.
They're already piling up on our front porch, and we're adding 80 million bodies a year to.
80 million extra people means nothing. 17 fathers and little girls that are piled up on my front porch because I had to shoot them or feed them, you know, his kids are mine. If I can create that reality, that this is your choice, I mean, the road, eat or be eaten kind of thing. If a grandmother can swallow the road in its implication, that it doesn't take much to flip our society upside down, at which point that's your choice. And now you have to say, do I want to do something about it before the fact?
That goes back to your original argument, though, when you were talking about trying to get people to do things with the beans and the cows.
Right. I mean, they can't. They're not wired up for that.
Desperate times call for desperate measures, and that is about as desperate as they come. Alpert says one way humans can cull themselves nonviolently is to give up their rights to have children. Reproduction will happen only for the lucky few drawn from a birth lottery run by the governments. This is horrible, but not as horrible, perhaps, as severe other alternative routes, such as die-off by starvation, nuclear war, or viral weapons. We'll get to that. To get the population reduced fast enough to save the planet, Alpert calculates the whole world could issue 350,000 birth permits a year. In the next 60 or 70 years, that would reduce the U.S. population, for example, to 40 or 50 million people, a number that could be supported by the natural resources of the country, perhaps. Alpert presents the way civilizations collapse, based on a death spiral model triggered by scarcity. Responses to scarcity bring more scarcity. And there's the spiral.
So what makes civilization collapse? Rome collapsed because of too much scarcity. Not enough food is grown. Not enough food got to market. What gets to market is bought by the rich. The poor cannot afford to eat. They get desperate and they fight to eat. The owners and the rich defend themselves. The fighting and defending consumes resources which make more scarcity, which makes more fighting, more defending. And I call this a civilization death spiral. One, if scarcity is diminishing, civilization death spiral does not trigger, which explains why civilizations thrive. Two, increasing scarcity triggers a spiral. Three, once the spiral is going, it keeps going. No further input, for example, from a failed harvest is required. Four, the civilization death spiral mechanism is embedded in every civilization. It was embedded in these four and five, they're all gone. The scarcity conflict death spiral is embedded in our civilization. Scarcity can cause failure. And when it does, it will affect all the people in the world. Why? Because previous civilizations did not share supporting resources. Chinese civilization could have scarcity and failure, and a Greek civilization wouldn't be affected by it. But today, all resources are shared in markets. Sea lanes allow wheat that's grown in Russia or China or Iowa to be delivered and eaten in Africa, Asia, or New York. And hidden by the market, a failed Russian harvest creates scarcity in Egypt. And hidden by a market, rich people don't even know when they are taking the food out of poor people's mouths. And they don't know where these people are. And when gas prices rise 10 cents a gallon in a day, most people don't know what caused it. And when oil rose from $70 to $140 a barrel in a few months, most did not know what caused it. However, because planting and fertilizing and transporting and processing all depend on fuel, food costs doubled, and it caused food riots. And the doubling of food costs reduces everyone's well-being. It increases everyone's scarcity, increases conflict between all individuals and institutions. And while poor nations riot, rich nations experience rising unemployment. And belligerence arises between neighbors. That's how Germany took Poland. And today, resource wars are putting consuming nations against nations that have resources or nations that have competing consumers. Everyone must defend themselves. Everyone pays for this defense. Everyone loses more well-being. Everyone experiences a little increase in scarcity, more defending. The death spiral kicks in. Global civilization collapses. And to make this dynamic more personal, this is my son, Benny. And Benny's life changes. I don't want this to happen to Benny. So my task tonight is to show what behaviors and system characteristics increase scarcity. Increase it enough to trigger a civilization death spiral and turn Benny into a gun-toting orphan. And in the end, I will show that saving Benny requires rapid population decline. So that's my work on my grandmother. She's got to believe that if we don't keep civilization from going under, her progeny are going to get crushed. So let me present a model that activates the death spiral.
Then he presents a kind of interactive graph of forces that create scarcity in the hopes of understanding what we might control to avoid the death spiral or even reverse it. Rex Weiler comments that many of the functions presented by Alpert were already predicted in the 1972 book Limits to Growth. Randy Savage points out that peak oil needs to be factored in, and women react differently than men. Bill Rees, who has been quiet until now, wonders if humans have enough rationality to find any solution at all. Filmmaker John Cooksey has a brilliant critique at this point, but I couldn't get it on the microphone. Alpert argues that declining population will create much more wealth rather than less. For example, if you have four grandparents, each with houses and assets perhaps, but only two descendants, they get two houses each. As the population declines, there will be more stuff and resources for each person on the planet. The argument that growth of population is necessary to create more wealth is stood on its head. Jack shows a video, which is available on his website at skill.org, that is skil.org. The video tries to answer this question. If everyone lived a North American lifestyle, how many humans can Earth support sustainably throughout time? That number, Alpert says, is far below 100 million. In the real world, people want to keep living well-fed, possibly on meat. They want to travel around, have normally acceptable homes and all that. We can do it, but only with the ideal population, just 100 million humans. It would be up to 300 million with some reductions in consumption. That takes us to the population that existed around the year zero in the Christian calendar, the time of the Roman Empire in the West. One of the main limitations, seldom taken into account, says Alpert, is the time it takes to regenerate soil. Currently, we are losing topsoil at a tremendous rate to water and wind erosion, plus draining micronutrients by overcropping. We replace some of the nutrients with fossil fuel-based fertilizers, which are not sustainable. Quoting Alpert from the online video, which he showed us, sustainable farming practice means the amount of soil lost equals the amount created. However, today's farming practice loses soil on average 16 times faster than Mother Nature makes it. That is, it would take 15 years to replace what is lost in a year of farming. On average, to be sustainable, after an acre is farmed, it would have to remain fallow for 15 years. This means we could only farm 1/16th of our land. The peaceful world population living in North American lifestyles with sustainable soil practices is 100 million people. A little later, he discusses whether permaculture can shorten that and increase the population somewhat, but that's the figures. But Alpert says even that 100 million figure is too high. There are other factors. For example, people want to live longer. Suppose through a medical advance or diet changes, humans reach an average life expectancy of 87 years instead of 86. That extra year increases their consumption by a little over 1%. We have to reduce the number of humans accordingly to keep things sustainable. Humans will always long for more improvements. With every increase in the ideal of consumption, the global population has to decrease accordingly. There can be continual progress, to a point, as long as the population continues to decline, says Alpert. To a point, because, and this caused a great deal of argument at the dinner meeting, because we do not know how many humans it takes to create our modern industrial lifestyle. Rex Weiler points to the numberless humans working behind the scenes, digging up ores, working in factories, transporting goods, repairing infrastructure. Could 100 million humans keep it all up? We don't know.
In 8 short years, everybody's worried about when the bad stuff's going to happen. In 8 short years, the rich will have taken it all. The poor will have nothing in their markets to purchase. The poor's land will have been purchased by the rich to grow food or flowers or park cars. And the poor will not eat. For example, 1 billion Chinese, Indian, and others in developing world's middle class are beginning to eat a little meat and drive their own cars. And when the poor hear a sucking sound in their meager markets, conflict and civilization will soon follow. So the idea is that the model is robust enough to predict that it's a pretty small number, and the time we have to come up with a way to get down to that small number is very short.
Another factor standing between the death spiral and the sustainably populated planet is the age-old problem: how are resources distributed between the rich and the poor? we know from history and sociological studies, a greater inequality of wealth with a hierarchy to enforce it is more unstable. The top-down world requires more resources and therefore a smaller population again. Alpert shows how a change in the distribution of wealth radically changes the number of humans Earth could support sustainably. I'm going to try to summarize using mostly Jack's own words, starting here. Take a world like our own, where 80% of the world's resources go to just the top 20% of humans, with the rest of humanity living on the remaining 20%. If we reduce the population to 1.6 billion, the number of people in both top and bottom are cut to 25%. So everyone, both rich and poor, will get four times the resources they would in a world of 6.4 billion people. Suppose the richest group, the top 20%, did not expand their consumption four times as they could, but just stayed at North American lifestyles. Just dropping the population to 1.6 billion would mean that without reducing anyone's well-being or creating any scarcity or civilization collapse, all the humans on Earth could attain North American lifestyles and well-being. What if the disparity between rich and poor was even greater? Suppose just 10% of the world's people consumed 80% of the resources. Then the calculation of how much the population would have to decrease to give everyone a North American lifestyle, it changes. We would have to reduce from 6.4 billion humans to a population of 800 million. That ends my edited quoting from Jack's dinner presentation in Vancouver. As you can see, hierarchies, wealth distribution, and inequality are huge factors when trying to figure out what the Earth can support sustainably. It depends not just on resources available, but what kind of society we have. To achieve sustainability, taking into account water usage, minerals available, clean energy, soil restoration, and room for other species, we would have to go way down from 800 million to 100 million or less. Jack says privately he would be surprised if the necessary germ warfare for a mass sterilization was not already developed by the major powers. There has been more than half a century of research since the end of World War II, when the German Nazi scientists were already working on purposeful diseases. Just consider all the private and university research into all the components, including genetics, that has been done since then. It's a nightmare scenario, which makes voluntary mass sterilization and a birth lottery sound more benign than a horrible die-off. We cannot discount the possibility of a racially designed death germ either. Perhaps an evil scientist or government will decide Earth shall be populated by only white people or Chinese people, Jewish or Arabic people. It's horrible to think about. We humans seem left with these horrible possibilities. I won't call them options. Number one, a political solution with voluntary mass sterilization and an international birth lottery to have the sterilization reversed to have a baby. That's Jack Alpert's only plan so far. Number two, germ warfare, whether designed or released by a government, a corporation, or a deranged biology student, it is all terrorism. There might be an accident. There might be a plan with a vaccine ready for chosen survivors based on race, nationality, ability to pay, or just dumb luck. And number three, endure a century of general chaos leading to massive die-off in disease, war, and starvation. And we will all suffer in that. And number four, a magical alien discovers us in time and transports most of the population to Eden-like planets. Stay tuned for three informal responses in my follow-up telephone interviews with Rex Weiler, Vandy Savage, and Bill Reese. All this makes Jack Alpert sound like a wild-eyed radical. Meet the man, and he's not. Like the time when people wouldn't save their own lives with Jack's invention of the seatbelt, he's frustrated we're creating a horrible future with overpopulation. Jack spent years with a research institute connected with Stanford University looking into why we don't make rational choices. Now, with the population bomb set to explode in everybody's faces, he's alarmed for the future of his grandchild and all kids. If he has to be the one telling us what we don't want to know, so be it. Jack Alpert is hard at work on a book explaining rapid population decline. We'll look for that. Meanwhile, try out the documents and videos at his website, skill.org. Note that skill has just one L in it. Radio EcoShock will be right back with three responses even as the overpopulated streets of the Middle East boil over. More than half of that population is under the age of 25, and half of those people are unemployed. From India to Mexico, population has doubled since 1950. It's a tsunami.
Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. We are mulling over a dinner meeting, a call for brain power, with guest Jack Alpert and six other bright green minds of Vancouver. The topics, as always, are how bad is it and what the hell are we going to do? Jack Alpert has explained why it's rapid population decline or bust. We only have a short time left to make a drastic reduction in population within the next 10 years, or utter chaos and mass dying will overtake much of the world. We'll start with host Rex Weiler, a mind much respected in Vancouver and around the world for his work with Greenpeace, as an organizer of peak oil, and as an author. Should we forget about consumption and just talk extreme population reduction? Let's talk with Rex Weiler. He's the co-founder of Greenpeace. He's the author of the truly authoritative history of that organization. Rex is on the Vancouver Peak Oil Executive, and his writing is published all over the place. Rex, I want to try like a nutshell of Jack Alpert's arguments on consumption, and his first point might be nobody here in the developed world is going to give up their cushy lifestyle, and that seems sort of true enough at this point. And second, everybody in the developing world wants the same lifestyle, and there's no way to stop them. And third, and this is his key point, I suppose, even if reducing consumption could work, it's too slow. By the time we make the changes required, the planet is toast climatically and biologically. So what's your response to that, Rex?
Well, the human situation is this. We are in what we call in ecology, we call habitat overshoot. That means there's too many humans consuming too much stuff for the habitat. Now, our habitat happens to be our entire planet. So there's nowhere else to go. And in habitat overshoot, what a species has to do, there's only one solution, and that's consume less stuff. Now, you can consume less stuff by having less people. You can consume less stuff by each person consuming less. Unfortunately, we already have, you know, most of humanity is living very modest and poor lives. It would be certainly feel unfair to ask those people to consume less. So really, we're down to asking the wealthy consumers, like most of us in Canada, for example, to consume less stuff, which is a reasonable assumption. Jack's approach in terms of talking about population is certainly true that one way to solve the problem of overshoot is to reduce the population, which I believe is something we have to do. I do not share Jack's belief that this can be done quickly in any way whatsoever. I think the reduction of the human population is going to happen over a long period of time, and I think it necessarily will take a long period of time, and therefore we have to raise the issue of consumption as well.
And he sort of is suggesting that we should try and shoot for a number, he suggests 100 million, where everybody could live basically the way they do now. I mean, maybe they'd be in electric cars instead of gas cars, but they could fly around on biofuels, or we would live the way we live now. And do you feel that's a realistic view?
No, I don't think it's a realistic view because, for one, I don't think we're not going to get down to 100 million human population anytime soon. Secondly, we cannot create the lifestyle we live now with 100 million people on the planet. You have to account for what does it take to actually have a high-tech economy. We're digging lithium out of the ground, you know, in places like Canada and Afghanistan, shipping it all over the world to build batteries and so forth. We're digging precious metals and rare earth metals from all over the world, shipping it around, massive manufacturing and production facilities and refining facilities and so forth. So you cannot necessarily scale down the top consumers in the global economy and think that those top consumers can carry on their lifestyle without everybody else who's actually supporting them underneath. In other words, we have the lifestyle that we live in Canada, for example, really depends on and requires farmers in Mexico, miners in Afghanistan and Africa, loggers in South America and Indonesia and so forth. So it's a little bit naive to assume that you could take, say, 100 million people and have them all consuming at the level of, say, your average Canadian without this full global infrastructure.
But it does seem like mainstream environment groups have stopped talking about population as an issue, maybe too hot to handle, or maybe it just can't be, you can't do anything with it right now. Do you think it's time to change that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think environmental groups have to talk about population. I'm glad that, for example, that Jack is raising this issue, because it's absolutely critical. It's important. I've never stopped talking about population as an issue. We have to stabilize and reduce human population. Some environmental groups have avoided this issue because it's very politically sensitive. People are afraid of something like the China solution of draconian government legislation prohibiting children and so forth. But here's one key secret to this whole population question is this. It can be solved without draconian government laws. You can improve the population growth level simply through women's rights, number one, and making contraception available worldwide. If contraception is available and if women have a choice over their own reproductive lifestyles, the human population will automatically go down. The birth rate will go down. This has been shown, this has been proven all over the world. So we can address the population in ways that do not necessarily result in injustice or individual loss of freedom. But we do have to understand that our concept of freedom is limited by what the Earth can provide. And the Earth cannot provide an infinite amount of resources for an infinite amount of people or a growing number of people. So, yes, we have to reduce the human population. We have to stabilize it first. Right now, we're adding about 80 million people a year. That would be like 40 cities the size of Vancouver. We're adding to the planet every year. This is just absolutely unsustainable. We can't even keep up with the infrastructure for those people, which is one reason why there are so many people going hungry and living on the edge of poverty.
Jack Alpert's vision is based on the possibility of a major crash or a great die-off. He thinks that will happen by whatever means, because it must happen for us to survive. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, I think it's more than a possibility. I think the die-off is already underway. There's about a billion people living on the edge of starvation on the planet. There's about 9 million people starve to death every year, literally starve to death. That's about 24,000-25,000 a day. That's 1,000 people an hour. So the die-off is well underway. And currently we cannot sustain the human population as it is. Now, some people will point to the fact that, well, there's lots of food, so therefore it's a distribution problem. Well, this is true. It is a distribution problem. The distribution problem, however, means that if we're going to share the food equally, then the people in Canada and the United States and the wealthy countries, the wealthy people of the world, are going to have to give up a share of their food wealth. This is something I don't see happening anywhere. I don't get a sense that anybody's willing to do that. I mean, some of us, many people like myself and others, are living more modest lifestyles and consuming less meat and consuming less in general. But this would have to be a massive undertaking to make a difference. But yes, I believe that the industrial society as we know it will collapse. I believe it's already in the process of collapse. I think the influences of peak oil and peak energy and peak commodities in general, the impact of global warming, impact of population growth and crowding and conflict and so forth will in fact cause the civilization as we know it to collapse. It's happened many times before in human history. We have not learned the lessons of human history. The civilizations have collapsed in Mesopotamia, on Easter Island, the Mayan civilization, many civilizations throughout history. In fact, almost all civilizations, the Roman Empire and so forth, have all grown too big, too fast, and collapsed. So the idea that that can happen on a global scale is not a stretch at all. It can happen on a global scale, and I think it will. Yeah, so our communities that learn to live a more modest lifestyle, more locally supplied, local self-reliance, localization, growing your local food and so forth, those communities will be the ones that are more resilient and able to survive.
And what about you, Rex Weiler? Are you working on another book, or do you have a project you want to tell us about upcoming?
Well, I'm constantly working on environmental ecological issues, doing research and writing. I publish a column called Deep Green, and your listeners can just Google my name, Rex Weiler, and Deep Green, and you'll get my column on at the Greenpeace website. And I'm working on a book on ecology and economics, because I believe that this is going to be the issue of the coming century, will be the reconciling human enterprise and human economics with ecological reality. So I'm working on that project.
We've just had a short chat with Rex Weiler, Greenpeace founder, historian, activist, and author. Find out more at rexweiler.com, and that's spelled W-E-Y-L-E-R. Thank you so much, Rex.
Hey, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it, Alex.
That was Greenpeace co-founder and historian Rex Weiler. Now we go for a woman's perspective. Wherever I go to record The Big Picture, The Real Deal, it seems like Vandy Savage is almost always there, not as a spectator, but as an organizer. She works crowds, she works people, and she works small miracles. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Canadian ecologist Vandy Savage. You were at a dinner meeting with Jack Alpert, who has got some radical ideas about population reduction. And it seemed to me part of Jack's plan to reduce population was to persuade grandmothers maybe to stop pressuring women to have kids. What was your reaction?
Well, certainly you can pressure people to not have children. China has done this, and they have a population fertility rate at about 1.8, 1.6. So that worked. It's a legal restriction, but there's all kinds of weirdness that's attached to that. For example, there's a lot of female infanticide because in that culture, men are considered much more important. And so if you're a 30-year-old male in China, there are not enough women, so now they're importing them from Korea and so forth. I'm not sure that's the wisest solution. In my view, a different solution is when you give women education and access to birth control, by themselves, women will have a lower fertility rate. In fact, I was just reading in our local newspaper, the Vancouver Sun, today in a column by Craig and Mark Kilberger, that in a meeting with the Dalai Lama, it was discussed that one single year of primary education for a girl, and they're referring to girls in India, can reduce fertility by 10% and increases their ability to earn wages by 10 to 20%. To me, the much more humane way to approach a radical reduction in population is a radical effort to educate women and give them easy, cheap, free access to birth control and support women in the world. That benefits us. It benefits our mothers, our sisters, our spouses, whomever it is. It's humane. And I also think as we do this and we become more equal, that we have a shot at world peace because we'll be born balanced.
I think men have a role to play, though. I know that, for example, when I was down in Mexico, I had many men bragging to me that they had 8 or 10 children. That was sort of the mark of them as a successful man. And we see that in many cultures, and it exists in our own culture. So there have to be adjustments to, I think, with men.
I agree. And I think machismo, which is really what you're referring to, is I'm so macho that the more kids I have, it's proof of my you know, virility. I think as women in our feminist movement, we have done men a huge disservice by not including them, because personally, I love men. I have 2 sons. I think men are fabulous. So your point is well taken. How do we redefine what is manly, what is machismo, what is virile? Because there's a lot of ways to do that that don't necessarily include having large numbers of children of proof of your manliness. I agree with you, Alex, and I think as women, we need to do a much better job letting our men know that we love them when we think they're awesome. And I think as men, we need to redefine how warriors, protectors, and all the things that men can offer, how that meshes with this new world that we're trying to create. You're right. We need to not exclude men.
Are you finding more women concerned about overpopulation, and what sorts of things might they say?
Well, most of the women in my group have had 2 children or less willfully, on purpose, not accidentally, because many of us read Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb. At this point, he was projecting we'd have 15 billion people on the planet. So that has greatly changed everything. In my view, the number one most fantastic invention of the last 100 years is birth control. Nothing to do with computers or the internet. So that's my perspective. But I think women really aren't going to choose to have fewer children unless they have other options in their life. Because our primary option, where we are honored and where we are respected, is for things like Mother's Day. So it's being a mother where we gain respect. As soon as we gain respect as scientists and writers and travelers and adventurers, as well as mothers, then that allows us to have community and social respect, not solely based on our ability to raise children.
Vandy, I'm so glad I called you because you said that really, really well. Is there anything you'd like to add, any projects you want to tell us about?
Well, right now I am working on a project with a really dear friend of mine, Terry. We're writing a project for young girls to empower girls to see and form the world in a new way. And hopefully we're presenting it to one of the women who was the founder of Discovery Channel, and we're just in the final stages of writing this. So in my view, what I would like to do with my life is not only be a political activist, which I am, and a fervent political activist, and not only walk the talk, I am trying to reduce my carbon footprint to as small as possible every day of my life, questioning my choices, which I screw up all the time. But I also am working for women's equality, and to your point, how do we have men fitting into this? As I mentioned, I have two sons who I love dearly, and I don't want them shunted out of the picture. And then the final thing, though, is how can we dream and vision a new way of living together? Because it is only in doing that, in living sustainably within community, that we visualize that, that we'll be able to create this vision and other people will be able to see it and say, wow, that sounds good. I want to be there. You mean shopping doesn't have to be my pastime? Maybe it's something really cool like looking at the stars at night? So I believe that we have to create a new vision because most people cannot see something that they've never seen before. So those of us that have an inkling can create this vision and make it so desirable that people are willing to change their current behavior and move toward this new way of living on the planet.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with green ecologist Vandy Savage. Thank you so much, Vandy.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
My thanks to Vandy Savage for doing her first radio interview. Now on to a veteran of Radio EcoShock, and by that I mean I've recorded every speech of Dr. Bill Reese I could get my hands on. His mind, which helped invent the whole idea of the ecological footprint, is a mind which teaches me new things every time I listen to him. Bill Reese is a planetary gem. Just joining us, we have the co-inventor of the concept of the ecological footprint, Dr. William Reese from the University of British Columbia. Professor Reese, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much.
First of all, humans are in a biological condition known as overshoot. We are consuming more than our resource base can sustain. Did you recently raise your estimate on how far beyond carrying capacity we are now?
I didn't personally, but we continue through something called the Global Footprint Network, which is actually run by one of my former PhD students, Matthias Wackernagel. Every 2 years, we undertake an analysis of the ecological footprints of nations and compare the aggregate consumption by the world's nations to the available, what we call biocapacity, the productive capacity of the planet, both to produce renewable resources and to assimilate waste such as carbon dioxide. And in the last few years, we've gone from roughly 30% to a 50% overshoot.
What does that mean? Could you just quickly tell us, what does that really mean for us?
Well, suppose you've got, let's say, $1 million in the bank, and it's returning 5% interest. That means that every year you could live on about $50,000 a year. And if you didn't spend any more than that, you'd be living on sustainable income. Okay, so $1 million in the bank at 5% per year returns $50,000 a year. You're not in a state of overshoot. But supposing you spend $60,000 a year, that means you're spending 20% more than your annual income of $50,000 a year. Now, you can keep doing that for a while because obviously you've got $1 million in the bank. But every year you expend more than the interest earned by your capital, you're reducing the capital. So in subsequent years, the capital won't be producing as much. So in effect, we've gone from spending 30% more than our annual interest to spending 50% more than our annual interest. And this means that we're continually and at an accelerating rate depleting the natural assets of the planet that produce vital resources for our survival. So soils are being eroded. The waste sinks, the carbon sink capacity is vastly overfilled, which is why carbon dioxide is accumulating in the atmosphere. Fisheries are collapsing. And deserts are expanding. So the habitable, productive land and waterscapes, the productive ecosystems required for human sustainability, are being reduced, even as we increase our demands every year.
Recently, we heard a presentation by Jack Alpert. Jack claims we need a rapid population decline to live modern lifestyles or perhaps to survive at all on a habitable planet. What is your reaction to this proposal to make rapid population decline our frontline priority?
Well, if you think of the ecological footprint, it's the demand that a population makes on the ecosystems. So two things are involved. One is population. The other is per capita consumption. So the human impact is a product of the total population times average per capita consumption. So Jack is perfectly correct. Population is one of the major contributors to that impact. But if we compare the contribution from population growth now to the contribution from rising material standards, rising consumption, population on the planet is growing at about 1%, a little less than 1% per year. Consumption growth is increasing at 2, 3, 4% per year, depending on where you look. So actually right now, consumption is driving the increase in the human footprint more rapidly than is population. You can't ignore either of them, but to isolate population as the only factor is an error and perhaps not the best step we could take.
Very good. Well, you have, Bill Reese, a new paper out published in the journal Sustainability, Science, Practice, and Policy. The title is What's Blocking Sustainability, Human Nature, Cognition, and Denial. Can you tell us about that, please?
Well, it's a very complex argument. It takes me back to my biological roots. And my dilemma in trying to understand how an allegedly intelligent species, one capable of looking at the data, of using rational analysis to understand what those trends mean, how can that species, when we see, you know, explosive growth in just about everything, including an accelerating climate change, how can we continue to reinforce the economic models and the various instruments of growth that are putting us in that dilemma? Why is it that we seem incapable of seeing the writing on the wall and making the changes in society necessary to bring us into a sustainable state? So if you ask that question, you have to go quite deep. Obviously, the superficial problem is the growing consumption of energy and resources. That's driven by two things. I argue that it's driven first by the natural human predisposition. It's a genetically driven predisposition to expand, to fill all available space. You know, our species has just about the widest geographic range of any advanced animal on the planet. So we've been enormously successful at occupying the planet. But we share another trait with all other species, and that's the tendency to consume all accessible resources. And in the human case, accessibility is really defined by technology. The better our technology, the more oil we can get, the more gold we can get. We can refine ever weaker or poorer qualities of ore, for example. So humans are on this track of expanding to fill all the space and using all of the resources, and that's an enormous driver to ecological destruction. But things are worse than that because it's reinforced by a cultural paradigm, if you like, or a cultural narrative based exclusively on growing the economy. So for at least the last 60 years, virtually every government and every major international agency has as the principal plank in its development platform increasing economic growth, which really means increasing the scale of the material economy, the sheer size of material and energy flows through the economy. So on the one hand, then you have biology giving us a predisposition to grow and a cultural model reinforcing that. So in some sense, we're in the worst of all possible worlds when you realize that the human enterprise, that is to say, all of humanity, this, what is it now, 6.8 billion people, and all of the artifacts and infrastructure of our big cities and so on and so forth, all of this is growing at a very rapid rate, 2, 3, 4% per year on a finite planet, which is in effect shrinking because we're despoiling the resources, wrecking the ecosystems, degrading the landscape. Well, anyone with a modicum of intelligence could argue that this isn't sustainable, that it can't go on forever, and yet we don't seem to organize ourselves politically or even personally to change the perceptions and behaviors that we engage in as a culture, as a society, in ways that would override the natural predisposition to expand. So the only way we're going to solve this problem is to give up on growth, to introduce global population policies, and to redistribute income so that consumption is redistributed. Half the human population is currently malnourished to some degree. Half are satisfied, and a billion people overweight. Well, that's an inequity that has to be resolved. And so if we're really serious about sustainability, it does mean stopping growth, redistributing wealth and income globally, and reducing population growth. In fact, we have to shrink the human population to survive equitably and sustainably on this planet.
But do we have the tools to do this mentally? Do we have the brain power? I mean, it's very well for the scientists to say, look, you're in big trouble. And as you've said, they've been saying that for several decades. But we've got these urges, these...
Well, that's exactly my argument, that we're not doing it because, first of all, because of those primitive expansionist urges, but we can change the developmental paradigm. We don't have to reinforce that gross biology. Right now, both nature and nurture are working against us. At the very least, if we exercise our intelligence, it should be able to overcome the natural instincts and the emotional attachment we have to the growth syndrome. If it can't do that, then I think we really are in very serious trouble. Nobody said this is a solvable problem. And I think we have to recognize that many, many previous cultures faced similar dilemmas and have either refused or have been unable to address them and hence have collapsed. So that this is yet another test of human beings as a conflicted species. Will our intellectual understanding, will our capacity for logic and reason finally outweigh our natural predispositions to expand and our tendency to believe in cultural myths such as the growth myth? And right now, there's no evidence that intelligence will outweigh those other dimensions of human nature. So I'm not saying this is a solvable problem at all. I am saying that one key to its solution is recognition of what those, what I call the distal causes are in our human nature and in our cultural narratives, and use that knowledge to, I suppose, educate the public to be prepared to accept such things as full cost pricing. Gasoline should cost in Canada $6 or $8 a liter, perhaps $20 a gallon in the U.S. That's the true social cost of using it. And if people were willing to accept that, the economy would change overnight in the direction of being more sustainable. That's just one example of many things that would have to happen, but they would be consistent with the analysis that I'm giving you. So far, we're not willing to do that. We're so entrenched in our existing ways, it's become a neural pattern, a cognitive block to moving forward. We simply are in denial about how serious this crisis is, and we've even got a multi-million-dollar denialist industry, if in effect funded by the corporate oil and corporate coal, to keep people in the dark, to prevent us from rising to the level of public intelligence that would enable truly sustainable policies to be put in place.
There's so much more to all of this.
There is. And we could go on all day.
I know we could and we can't, but I hope we could do a longer interview with you at a later date. But I really thank you for chipping in on this conversation. We've just heard from Dr. Bill Rees. He's the co-inventor of the concept of the ecological footprint. He's with the School of Regional and Community Planning at the University of British Columbia in Canada. Thank you so much, Dr. Rees.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Alex. Surely there are less extreme visions of our future and better solutions. In the weeks to come, you'll hear some different ideas on confronting our crisis. As promised, I'm also working on the Transition Town movement, finding ways we can stabilize our local situation despite the coming shocks to our economy, climate, and energy supplies. Thanks to your word of mouth, our podcast list is climbing by 100 a month. Around 2,000 people from around the world download Radio EcoShock every week. Please support your local campus or community radio station. If they don't carry Radio EcoShock, just a few emails or letters from you can make it happen. If there is a station fundraising, I encourage you to give generously to community radio. If you don't have community radio in your area, residents of the United States can now set up low-power FM stations. Contact the Prometheus Project at prometheusradio.org to find out how. All the audio you heard today was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Feel free to spread it around. Please do. Help dig us out of this hole. Maybe our guest next week can shed more light. Dr. Paul Ehrlich, author of The Population Bomb, is scheduled to join us talking about his new book. I'll also have the senior editor of Grist magazine, Lisa Hymas, with her plan to help the population problem. So take heart. Maybe we'll muddle through, even if Jack says we won't. I'm Alex Smith. Get all our past programs from the website ecoshock.org. Thank you for working your brain.